I'm telling these tears go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me.
What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Hahn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. It's Friday, and we are busy today. There's a ton of news happening. We've got guests basically throughout the show. You're not going to want to miss a single second of it. We might even get in some time to give away some fabulous tickets to the Brewers-Texans game that is coming up on Monday. Let's see if we can all get it in here, Brian, shall we? Let's just jump right in. Major ruling coming down today from the U.S. Supreme Court, frankly, I think surprising some court watchers. Today, the Supreme Court upheld a federal law that prevents people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders from having firearms. Again, I think a bit of a surprise to many court watchers. I'm really very, very pleased, and I feel fortunate that we've got an expert with us to help us understand that decision. We're joined with attorney Ryan Pogolinski, clinical assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law. Good afternoon, professor. Thanks so much for joining us. What did the court rule today?
Wow. So this is a great day for folks that are concerned with domestic violence victims and their safety. So the Supreme Court ruled today that it is not a violation of federal law to ban people who have been subject to civil restraining orders from having access to firearms. So specifically in Wisconsin, if a person has a restraining order against them, there could be a firearm ban, and the court has ruled that that is okay due to the fact that it's for the safety, and courts have the ability to regulate that.
In this 8-1 ruling, Chief Justice Clarence John G. Roberts said that, quote, when a restraining order contains a finding that an individual poses a credible threat to the physical safety of an intimate partner, that individual may, consistent with the Second Amendment, be banned from possessing firearms while that order is in effect. He also wrote, some courts have misunderstood the methodology of our recent Second Amendment cases. These precedents were not meant to suggest a law trapped in amber. It's a fairly artful way of referencing this, I'm going to call it obsession, professor, that the currently constituted mm-hmm. Supreme Court has with, quote, historical practice and the traditions of the United States. What is Roberts getting at that? Specifically in reference to the bump stock case that was decided last week, striking down that federal regulation? How do we make sense of that? What's really going on here?
Sure. So, in the current the case regarding the domestic violence ban on firearms, historically this goes back to the Revolutionary War. Where the federal government had exercised the power to disarm people who've been deemed dangerous, irresponsible, or otherwise unfit to possess firearms. So this is nothing new. And like I said, that we've been doing it historically. And this was an argument that was made under the Second Amendment. Now, in the bump stock case, which is totally different, and for those who aren't aware of what bump stocks are, but they basically, they were invented in the early 2000s. And they replace a rifle stock and utilize a recoil to basically rapidly shoot a firearm. There's been some allegations that it could be a machine gun. And after the Las Vegas massacre in 2019, we shifted and we basically said that bump stocks were not allowed. And the court has ruled last week that that was basically an error. And this is not a federal rule, so this is just overturning a law. That says that these are not considered machine guns and therefore not illegal guns. So they're completely, while they both deal with the firearms and the Supreme Court, it may have looked like they were somewhat related. They kind of were decided on two separately different issues.
Absolutely. One of the things that I find really interesting, of course, is again that emphasis on what is this historical practice that the federal regulation, rule, or other statute is relying on for its constitutional basis, right? Different laws, different type of thing that we were talking about, two totally different outcomes, but floating around there in the ephemera is some of the same logic. It seems incredible to me, right, that even in this case, the lone dissenter, big surprise here, not at all, actually, was Clarence Thomas, who authored the Bruin decision. And he wrote in the decision that came down today that, quote, not a single historical regulation justifies the statute at issue, yet you just referenced one. And even when we turn to the bump stock case, what's troubling to me is that bump stocks didn't exist historically, right? Those weren't a thing. So how do you even turn to this same rubric of historical practices in that case, which was, again, a line of thinking that really undergirds and stitches together so much of, again, this Supreme Court as it's currently constituted with the three Trump appointees? A lot of their jurisprudence seems to bring up these traditional old notions, and that you have to tie a regulation back to that, otherwise it's presumptively unconstitutional. Is there a tension here? I mean, how useful is that rubric when we have technologies, we have scientific advancements that would have boggled the mind of our founding fathers?
Right. And you know, you've kind of hit the nail on the head that they, you know, historically, we did not have bump stocks, like I mentioned. I mean, we didn't get those until the 2000s. And so, again, I think it boils down to, and this court's been very consistent on going back to the rule of law and how it was meant by our founders, which typically is a conservative view. And what they're, you know, what they're saying is, it's not about what the gun is, it's what who should have access. And should we all have access as it looks to be under the Second Amendment? And so, for instance, if they're saying a bump stock isn't a machine gun, they're arguing about what that machine gun is. They're not arguing who can have that weapon. And that's a different, so that's a different issue under the Second Amendment versus the rules with the bump stock. And I think, yeah, we're gonna see that continue to evolve. And with this court, I very supportive of gun rights. And so again, I was very impressed and happy with the ruling today that they did rule in this domestic violence issue, because there was a lot of concern with us that do represent victims of crime, and specifically domestic violence victims, that they were going to go in a different direction and allow perpetrators and people who I deem to be dangerous to have weapons, or exact weapons, not specifically, we're just talking about guns specifically, but
how surprised were you, Professor? Yeah, how surprised were you by the decision today? It shocked me.
Very shocked. I was shocked. In fact, I'm home with my kids this week, and so I went outside, looked at the news, and I was like literally jumping for joy and shocked, because I really thought it was going a different way. So I think that this is definitely a win for those of us who work with victims.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Professor. My guest to kick off the show today, Attorney Ryan Pogolinski, Clinical Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law. Thank you so much for your time, Professor. Keep up the good and important work. We all appreciate it. There's a little unwritten piece of this, and I was trying to get at this a bit. Again, there is tension that exists within these decisions from the Supreme Court. I find it pretty difficult to stitch together what I would call a consistent approach. Simply by calling something or invoking the same principle over and over again does not actually mean that the decisions are consistent, right? It simply means that they're basically forcibly calling the decisions consistent. And what I mean by that to say is that it certainly appears that the Supreme Court, while claiming to follow, a consistent or steady set of interpretation principles or guiding principles of how to interpret and apply the Constitution, that their decisions at time not only seem to be inconsistent, they seem to be highly partisan. And secondly, that where the decisions break for what would be, frankly, the more liberal argument here on the side of domestic violence victims and survivors, that they do that when the public reaction to the decision might be so overwhelmingly negative that they're finding it hard to get there. So again, I was shocked by this decision. I find it really hard to square with this court's current jurisprudence in this arena. And again, what really bothers me, and you all, if you've been listening to me for a while, certainly heard me invoke and frankly, attack this Supreme Court's obsession with this idea of historical practice and these principles that were around these traditional principles that must date back to the 1700s. Because here's what. That's nice if you were a white landowning man back then, because those historical precedents and principles really worked well for you. But if you're a person of color, a woman, a member of the LGBTQIA community, or the victim of gun violence when someone was using a bump stock, which didn't exist when they wrote the Second Amendment, maybe that approach doesn't work so well with you. And this presumption that's baked into everything that they're doing these days, that simply by invoking historical practice, that how simply is the constitutional magic wand, is a bit disgusting, frankly. When we come back, got some other major legal news to cover. Aileen Cannon's at it again in the Southern District of Florida. Alvin Bragg's back in court over the gag orders. There's just so much going on. Oh, and it's been 114 days since this Supreme Court took up the presidential immunity case. I don't know what they're waiting for. Perhaps November 5th. TikTok, TikTok. All that coming up and so very much more. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us. 855-75-CIVIC. 855-752-4842.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
What's up, Wisconsin? We're back. It's going to be a fast-moving Friday, I can tell you that much. Just so much going on in the news. I'm going to try to get all of the important stuff in for you. Not to worry. Of course, Aileen Cannon's at it again, back in the Southern District of Florida. Again, this is the Trump, I stole our super, super secret spy documents for, I'm not sure what reason. That's this case, Judge Aileen Cannon, a Trump-appointed attorney who we now come to find out who was asked not once but twice by her colleagues in the Southern District of Florida to politely decline to hear the Trump case. A judge who was smacked down, like judges very infrequently are, by a three-panel federal appeals court, including two Trump-appointed judges, for basically some really stupid rulings in this related case that Trump tried to file that absolutely everyone understood was garbage, tried to file it to stop the super secret spy documents case. So what's going on today? Well, today, Judge Cannon is having a hearing today, listening to arguments from lawyers about what might you want to know? Oh, whether or not the special counsel should even exist, whether or not Jack Smith and his investigation of Trump stealing our super secret spy documents, that Jack Smith can't even really investigate that because his very appointment, the very creation of the special counsel's office is, according to Trump's lawyers, unconstitutional. Now, what's extraordinary about this case or this hearing today
is not just that the argument is stupid. These kinds of stupid arguments are made all the time by criminal defense attorneys. It's part of the strategy, the strategery, if you're a George W. Bush fan. That happens all the time. But what typically federal judges do is they just deny the stupid motions. They don't require briefing, and they certainly don't require argument. Here, on this stupid motion, Judge Cannon not only scheduled briefing, she demanded briefing, frankly, fairly extensive briefing. She allowed briefing by non-parties. So not coming from Donald Trump's criminal defense team, not briefing coming from the Department of Justice, but, you know, anybody who might want to weigh in. I wonder if we're going to get some really cogently written, calm, sensible briefs from people who might just want to weigh in on the former MAGA president's super secret spy documents case. Yeah, no, of course, there was a flood of these. So not only does she entertain the stupid motion, not only does she fail to simply rule on the stupid motion, more on that in a second, she schedules briefing. Not only does she schedule briefing, she allows briefing by non-parties. And then not only does she agree to hear the stupid motion, accepted briefing, she then schedules an all-day hearing on it and allows non-parties to make arguments at the hearing. I'm here to tell you that never happens. Ever, ever, ever. It's totally bizarre.
So, like,
wacky.
Just to make it clear, let's say you're on trial for murder, right? And
yeah,
I'm not even a witness. I'm just a, let's just say like Dan O'Donohue, who I don't have anything to do with, who's on trial for murder, right? And
yep.
It's as if I just got to go and talk about it in front of the court just to say what I had to say about it, even though I'm like, have no idea what the heck's going on.
Yeah, that's it.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense. When your name is Aileen Cannon and you're a shill for Donald Trump, instead of being the arbiter of justice in our country and trying to make sure that voters have the information that they need to evaluate this man for the highest office in the land and arguably the leader of the free world. And here's why this is so stupid. Courts have heard this argument over and over and over again, and they have always concluded that the special counsel is constitutional. Oh, wait, wasn't there a whole thing about that? Yes, yes, it was Richard Nixon, for crying out loud. The court ruled in the Nixon case, meaning the Supreme Court, that the then independent counsel was absolutely constitutional. And by the way, it was those independent counsel statutes that were revised. They were revised to limit the power of the independent counsel. Why? After the Ken Starr fiasco, remember Ken Starr and Monica Lewinsky and the blue dress in the Oval Office, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, well, Ken Starr took that independent counsel investigation, which basically had unlimited power allocated to the independent counsel. And that thing took something like 4 years to conclude, burned through hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars. And we all know that Bill Clinton did some pretty obnoxious stuff in the Oval Office. It was after that experience that the federal government went, well, we need to maybe limit the independent counsel, and maybe they shouldn't be the, quote, independent counsel. They should be a special counsel, and they should actually have some, again, guardrails on their authority and how they determine what they can investigate. So they changed the laws to change the independent counsel. It's now the special counsel's office. In other words, the special counsel that just prosecuted Hunter Biden, yeah, that same one. That's how stupid this is. And it was the Nixon case. That case found that the independent counsel, the virtually unlimited authority of the independent counsel, that counsel was constitutional. And the entire nucleus, the core, the nexus of Trump's argument that the special counsel here, that Jack Smith, that his powers are unconstitutional, it's because he's a, quote, superior officer that needs to be confirmed by the Senate because he has such broad powers. Okay, so you get what I'm saying? Special counsel, which is what we have today, way less powers than the Nixon independent counsel, than the Ken Starr independent counsel. But we already know from U.S. v. Nixon that the independent counsel with nearly unlimited powers already passed constitutional muster. And yet, Mensa member Aileen Cannon, not only having briefing on the stupid motion, allowing briefing from third parties, has now blown yet another day allowing argument, a hearing on this stupid, stupid motion. Bravo. Well done, Aileen Cannon. Yet again.
See, and here I am thinking that, you know, the law should apply equally to all parties because that's how the law should work. But I guess no.
And before we run out of time and I run out of breath, I have to point this out. Alvin Bragg filed a motion today, a brief, to keep the gag order in place in Trump's criminal hush money, voter manipulation, criminal proceeding in New York. You know, the one where he's a 34-time convicted felon. And in that motion, which I downloaded, of course, he states and talks about all of the claims that the defendant made in its motion, that Trump made in its motion to open up, to lift the gag order, and says things like categorically false accusations. Those claims are lies. There's no factual basis for this assertion. Finally, a lawyer is calling Trump what he is in a legal document. A liar, a filthy, stinking liar. Thank you, Alvin Bragg. That's all I've got time for. We're going to take a couple of quick messages. We'll be right back. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You shot me! You shot me right in the arm!
Audio okay. I also have.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I think I'm going to have to do just a day ticker every day from now until when the Supreme Court issues its immunity decision. We're nearly certain to get to the end of business today without a decision. That will mark the 114th day without a decision. Just for context, everyone listening out there, the United States Supreme Court got the Nixon case done in 54 days from the time that the court agreed to take it up to full issued decision, which was unanimous with one justice who didn't rule in that case, you know, because of a conflict of interest, which two of these guys clearly have, but I digress. 114 days versus 54. You do the math, and anybody can prognosticate as to why that is happening. But the topic of this hour with our next legal expert is Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell. She is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law and Professor of International Peace Studies at the Kroc Institute at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Welcome back, Professor O'Connell. It's my privilege to have you again.
Thank you, Maggie. It's great to be with you again. You know, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so talking with you feels like coming home.
Well, welcome home in the virtual sense. Where do we stand now in Gaza, Professor O'Connell? And secondly, what are the things that are proving to be the impediments to some sort of negotiated peace, even if it is time delimited in some way?
It's so heartbreaking. Just 2 weeks ago, we had some hope that President Biden's proposal for a peace agreement might actually break through, lead to hostages being liberated, leading to a ceasefire and the delivery of desperately needed massive amounts of aid to Gaza. We haven't heard a word in days from Washington, from any world capital on a ceasefire, a peace agreement, release of hostages from Gaza. So we're not in a good place. and were just watching utter devastation beyond anything I could have imagined occurring when this conflict broke out. So it's a place where we desperately need a ceasefire now. I could talk about how I see that happening, but I don't want to get the tragedy in Gaza to take all of our attention, because it comes in a context and is related to the tragic ongoing war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And one place where there is more world attention at this moment, the catastrophe in Sudan. So these are the two major armed conflicts that I've been watching for the last 2 years, starting with Ukraine and then the unfathomable civil war in Sudan and now the long-running violence in Gaza. So we've got three major world violent conflicts that are unresolved, that are causing incredible amounts of damage, destruction, tragedy, and resource allocation that should be going for all the world's problems. We've got climate change problems that are reaching into this country right now. I'm sure you're aware of the news of the tragedies in Mexico, where temperatures hit 125 degrees Fahrenheit, and this is related to climate change, which we are doing nothing about while we ship vast amounts of weapons around the world for conflicts, which also contribute to climate change in ways that we seem never to talk about. So these conflicts have to be resolved immediately. All three of them, the U.S. can play a role. Interestingly, the U.S. has the greatest leverage with regard to Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I appreciate hearing your views why President Biden doesn't take the step of cutting off weapon sales and completely isolating Israel so that it will negotiate a ceasefire. He put a plan forward, very strangely calling it Israel's plan. That didn't go anywhere for, I think, plain reasons. But what I didn't understand is when both sides in the conflict refused to negotiate, why the president didn't cut off weapons and say, it's time to talk. We're not going to continue fueling this futile war that will only lead to the next tragedy. We should have been doing much more with regard to Ukraine from the get-go on two fronts. Part of the reason why this conflict broke out was because of Vladimir Putin's maniacal view that he could become a world hegemon like the United States, because the U.S. had kicked over the normal rules of international law, which are based on equality and not having a hegemon, without continuing to pursue that view, which President Biden has done in ways we can talk about, even in greater extent than some of his predecessors. Putin said, okay, that's it. I'm going to do the same thing. So the U.S. had two things it should have done from the get-go. We should have gotten back in line ourselves with international law, and we should have brought the rest of the world on board. Why are the Chinese and the Indians paying for, helping finance Putin's war? Putin can't wage the war without that.
Without them.
Yeah. And then Sudan. Again, it's a story of why has the U.S. not used its resources to help rebuild and create good governance throughout Africa? Why have we put our resources into unending uses of military force? Do you know, in the last year of the Trump administration, the United States attacked Somalia 60 times. That is 6-0. Mm. Look at Somalia today. What good did any of that do? And its neighboring country, Sudan, now is in free fall because the U.S. leads with this terrible message of violence pays, violence is the only answer, violence is the way that the U.S. stays on top of the world. We don't even absorb the lesson that we're not on top of the world. All the discussion about our rivalry with China now, China's increasing aggression in the South and East China Seas, we're not leading through the law of peace. And that's a desperate situation. But Saudi Arabia, our good buddies, who were about to apparently send even more weapons to, this is the country that, of course, devastated Yemen with an unlawful intervention in a civil war. Saudi Arabia seems to be the one state that's in a position to really do some serious negotiation for a ceasefire in Sudan. So why isn't the U.S. putting pressure on our pal, Saudi Arabia, to get a result there? Why are we just wringing our hands and saying, oh, this is terrible, when we have some real leverage over the party that can make a difference? I really appreciate hearing why you think President Biden is not acting
well
in all three conflicts.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I wanted to suss out. And first, a definition of terms for all you listening out there at home in your cars. Hegemon is the sort of term of art that's used amongst political scientists and those that study international law. It describes a country that really, through its size, its economic power, its military strength, basically can almost steer where the entire global political discourse, as well as varying groups of aligned, if not formal, alliances of countries. If you think back into the Cold War era, you had basically a two-hegemon world political atmosphere where it was the USSR and the United States that really drove everything that was happening within the world order, with some, I think, exceptions. But that's, I think, how most folks would understand that from a layperson's perspective. What you heard Professor O'Connell describing is that the liberalization of that idea that liberal, and I mean small L, democratic, small D concepts, say we want to move away from hegemonic powers, that we need more of a power sharing approach to the global order. And so it begs this question of, if the United States claims, as it has, regardless of party, to be the shining city on the hill, when the U.S. itself engages in violations of international law or the law of war, what does that mean? In other words, even without a sort of hegemonic, where you've got two powers or a couple of major powers that are driving the global order, what does the U.S., the manner in which the United States conducts itself on an international stage, what are the domino effects of that, especially over an extended period of time? And I think this, Professor O'Connell, really strikes at the heart of your question. And that is what my perception is that behind closed doors, and certainly at the State Department and through every diplomatic means, President Biden is assuredly applying maximal pressure that he can. What you're pointing to is what is being said on the public stage, what is visible to other countries, what is visible to the American people about how we will conduct our foreign policy, how we will apply the leverage that the United States has to be an advocate for peace, to stand for human rights. That is the tension point that we're in. And then you layer on the challenges of this election year, not just that it's an election year, but an election year where the alternative to President Biden is a man so thoroughly unfit, running a party so unhinged from any democratic principle that is articulable, frankly, any set of policy principles which one could articulate at any level of detail. I'm interested to see what sort of platform comes out of the RNC, since there wasn't one last time. What does all of that mean? How does one navigate what are, I think, incredibly challenging moments, when you're looking at Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan? But all of this is we're seeing in those regions, not just what has occurred during Joe Biden's presidency, not just what occurred and the result of what Donald Trump did, but I would argue across both Democratic and Republican presidents, a trending towards very selective engagement. Engagement, as you rightly, and I agree, Professor O'Connell, pointed out, military interventions that weren't always coupled by every bit of leverage possible to bring about peaceful resolutions and to support the autonomy and self-governance of nations, especially within the developing world. I have to take a breath. Professor O'Connell, what do you think is coming next? What are the precursors to peace? We have just about a minute, especially as we look towards Gaza. And if you feel comfortable, when you look at the two candidates for president, which one do you think poses the greatest possibility for peace going forward?
Maggie, I think we've for too long decided that the end justifies the means in this country. And our presidents have become arrogant in thinking that they're the only answer. And if they have to skirt the rules in order to make sure that you know, the right thing is done, that our national interests, and that's why we're in the mess we're in. I understand the stakes of untangling it now, because I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but I am a fan of the rule of law, and there's no excuse for Joe Biden to use this election not to honor the law at home and abroad.
I call on the president to embrace that complexity, to speak about the complexity, but also to call out what is clear when clarity is also what is needed. My guest has been Mary Ellen O'Connell, the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law and International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. I will be in touch, Professor, because I think it's important we talk again very soon. My thanks to you. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go anywhere.
There's nobody bigger or better at the military than I am.
Welcome back, Wisconsin, and happy Friday, everybody. Really excited to be joined now by Carrie Schumann, the executive director of Wisconsin Conservation Voters, because it is day 15 of Joe Biden's top 100. We're going to talk a little bit about what, you know, environmental justice looks and feels like and why it's so important. And of course, what Joe Biden has been doing about it. Welcome, Carrie. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
100%. The term environmental justice, I'm assuming not everybody's heard of it. Tell me what that means and why it's important to every single person in Wisconsin.
Sure, absolutely. You know, part of the reason I thought this was a good topic for right now is we're having some crazy weather, this extreme heat, we're having crazy storms. And those, you know, weather events are sort of a reminder of how we're not all impacted equally by what happens in the environment. You know, environmental justice is really looks at the fact that there are entire communities that have been left behind when it comes to things like making sure our water is safe to drink, making sure that we have clean air to breathe, making sure that we live in a healthy, clean environment. And so when I look at what's happening right now and think about the weather we're having and that sort of thing, you look at the heat we're having. You know, if you live in a neighborhood with a lot of trees, you have a little bit of a buffer from the heat. It really does help cool things off. If you live somewhere that where it's sort of a concrete jungle and there is no tree cover, it's quite a bit hotter and affects you more. That's just one example. I would say one other big example is power outages. You know, I was without power for 24 hours during that storm a few weeks ago. And, you know, for me, it was not that big of a deal. But if you're somebody who has, let's say, a disability and you're homebound and you're stuck in your house and you can't get anywhere and you have no, it clearly has a larger effect on you. Or if it's you're in this kind of heat that we're in right now and you don't have air conditioning or you don't have fans, we are not all impacted equally. And too often it's low-income communities that are impacted the most by the environmental problems or communities of color. So that's why I thought right now in this moment we're in is the perfect time to make sure people understand what environmental justice is.
So looking at the next election cycles coming up, what really stands out? What races matter the most to Wisconsinites?
Well, as always, we're the eye of the storm, right? So everybody's watching the presidential in Wisconsin and what happens on the presidential here. Everybody's watching to see what happens with Senator Tammy Baldwin and her reelection. The whole country sort of watches us. But then in Wisconsin, since we just, got these new fair maps for our legislature, it's a whole new ballgame. And there are all of a sudden a whole bunch of districts around the state where we could elect pro-environment, pro-democracy candidates to office and really completely change the feel and look and feel of the state legislature.
I think it's so important. You know, I'm from Milwaukee, and I always try to make sure that even when I'm talking about a Milwaukee issue or an issue that you see more in urban areas, that we try to emphasize also why it matters in upstate Wisconsin and in other regions. This is one of those things, right? Whether we're talking about clean water or PFAS cleanup, right? Environmental justice also deeply matters in rural communities as well. It is the case that a lot of time large polluters, corporations will put their businesses in very rural places because the tax incentives or the job creation incentives are so strong in those places. When we think about the policies and the bills that might be coming up in Wisconsin this year that impact not just Milwaukee or Madison or Dane or even Kenosha and Racine, but really matter statewide for everybody, no matter where we live, what pops to the top of your mind, Carrie?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is not just an urban problem. It's an urban problem and a rural problem. 100% agree with that. When I look at what the Biden administration has done, just a few days after taking office, President Biden signed an executive order authorizing something called Justice 40. And the idea is that 40% of all of the federal benefits, money, et cetera, that are flowing for climate change, for sustainable and affordable housing, for clean energy, that 40% of that needs to go to communities that have been previously under-resourced and marginalized, which first time this has ever been done. So it was a big, big change for the federal government. There were, I think there's over 20 federal agencies that had to like really figure out how do we do this? And yet they are doing it. They have really embraced it and are moving it forward. And making sure that these resources are going directly to communities that most need it. I'll give one example for Wisconsin. Just not that long ago, not that many weeks ago, $124 million was allocated to Wisconsin from the federal government for residential solar panels. So that means solar panels on your house. So, you know, if you're, you know, upper middle income or upper income, you can afford to put that upfront investment to put solar on your house. If you're not, you can't. And so the idea with this Solar for All program is that half of the money will go to tribal housing and half to other low income and housing. And people will be able to put solar panels on their houses, which for them means lower utility bills. That's a win. They're helping to do their part to improve, to reduce carbon emissions and make a difference on climate change. That's a win for all of us. And this kind of investment in solar panels is a huge workforce and economic development piece. It's getting more people working in good paying jobs. So it's a win for everybody. And that's a perfect example of how Justice 40 is being implemented at the Wisconsin level.
It's really an impressive array of basically the whole of government approach to these problems that has become really a hallmark of Joe Biden's administration. I wanted to call out one other program. It's the Workforce Opportunity for Rural Communities. It's basically a grant-based program. It helps get funds into community colleges. Five rounds of grants have been passed out already, totaling around $15 million per year. Again, mainly focused on rural job training. That's just one example within this Justice 40 initiative. Thank you so much for being here, Carrie. Very quickly, where can people find out more about Wisconsin Conservation Voters?
Sure. Thanks for asking that. So people can go to conservationvoters.org to learn more about what we do and get involved in our programs. We work on democracy, safe drinking water, climate change, clean energy, and just working to make Wisconsin a better and healthier place for all of us to live.
And thank you for that, Carrie. That's my guest, Carrie Schumann, the executive director of Wisconsin conservation voters. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. News, weather, and sports are next. And I've got it. Up next, another really special guest. It's a busy, busy Friday, y'all. Thanks again, Carrie. And we'll be back in just a moment.
I don't think the heavy stuff's going to come down for quite a while.